Welcome to Bubbles and Benevolence, the podcast where we pop the bubbles to success and dive deep into the benevolent hearts of those who have achieved it. In this podcast, we'll sit down with successful business leaders, philanthropists, nonprofit workers, and more to discuss their journeys, the lessons they've learned along the way, and how they're using their success to make a positive impact on the world. So grab a glass of bubbles and join us as we explore the intersection of business and benevolence and discover what it truly means to be successful. Hi everyone, my name's Jamie, and if you don't know me, I've been working alongside Marisa at Hamworth House for the last 5 years. We wanted to celebrate International Women's Day this week with the launch of our podcast, and for the inaugural episode, we'll be interviewing Marisa herself. Whether you're already familiar with Marisa or you've just stumbled across our podcast today, this is a great opportunity to get to know her a bit better and perhaps even learn something new and surprising. Marisa Vecchio is an accomplished Australian businesswoman and philanthropist who's held various leadership roles in the medical accreditation industry and has been recognised for her contributions to our community. Her exceptional leadership, unwavering dedication and commitment to excellence have garnered her countless accolades, including being appointed a member of the Order of Australia, winning the Queensland Telstra Businesswoman of the Year Award, and receiving an honorary doctorate from QUT. Currently, Marisa has shifted her focus towards entrepreneurship and philanthropy, taking on the role of chatelaine at Hamworth House. Welcome to your podcast, Marisa. How does it feel?
I've never had a podcast before. I'm a bit excited.
To start off today, we've got our bubbles. And what is your favourite bubbles that you brought along?
Oh, well, I'm sure there's going to be so many people that are just so surprised by the fact, of course, it's champagne, which I actually didn't drink till I was in my 40s. I actually didn't even know the existence of it. I was a girl that grew up on Riccadonna and Asti Spumanti because that's what my mum used to drink. But it was quite a like world-revealing moment when I had my first glass of champagne. So, of course, I would have to say my favourite champagne for a whole lot of reasons is Veuve Clicquot. And I just happened
to have the champagne of the house.
Of course, the champagne of Hamworth House. But I just happened to have a bottle I prepared earlier here, a beautiful glittery bottle, which actually our daughter gave me for the 155th anniversary of Hamworth a few years ago. And it's actually still not open, so I think we should do something about that very
Absolutely.
Soon.
Absolutely. It'll be a good celebration for the 160th birthday.
That's true. I think if it lasts that long, another few months.
Hopefully Bella will be able to be here with us to open it.
Well, that would be great. But it's always actually on my shelf in this beautiful office of mine, and always reminds me that there's all those little small milestone celebrations. So I think, yes, Veuve Clicquot, which I think we have poured ourselves a glass of to toast the start of the podcast. So cheers.
Cheers.
Let's hope this is the start of a wonderful journey.
Before we go into Hanworth House, I want to go back a little bit and talk about how your journey first started. And you were a CEO for quite some time. What motivated you to pursue that career?
Well, I guess if I go back even further than that, I was a girl who graduated high school and I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I think everybody sort of expected me to land into law or medicine. And because I was pretty dedicated at school, I didn't like to fail. You know, I kind of was a really hard worker. And so when I chose to go into the arts music area, I think a lot of people were very surprised. In fact, it was probably a terrible decision now that I look back, because I actually learned that even though I thought I was a really good pianist, I actually wasn't. And compared to everyone else around me, I was not good enough to perform and definitely not good enough to teach and not patient enough to teach, I guess, is probably more appropriate. And so I kind of found myself graduated from university without a job, which a lot of arts graduates often find themselves in. And it was by default that I ended up getting a job which basically projected me onto a pathway towards business, which was working for the Predella Group in Brisbane, an organisation that was building hotels, and it was kind of when Expo was starting. And so I landed into a really interesting career kind of getting into hotel management. And then I realised that perhaps the world of business was more inclined with where I was at in my life, which was great for me because I could actually use my artistic streaks and my creativity. And in fact, that was something that I really explored a lot when I did work with the College of GPs and with AGPAL, which was the organisation I became the CEO of, which was a national organisation that was setting about doing a very challenging thing, which was setting standards in general practice. Imagine trying to convince a doctor that they needed to have standards when they were already doctors. So I kind of loved the challenge of that and I thrived on it. And I think we built a really successful business in conjunction with the medical profession and we ended up accrediting. Actually, if you go to your local GP, you'll probably find a logo on their door, which was the organisation that I was very proud to have been a part of starting. So that's really how it happened in terms of the business world. And I did kind of travel through a myriad of different medical hurdles that got me to a CEO position. Somehow, if I look back, I don't even know how that happened, but it was a great journey and one that I wouldn't have changed for the world.
What made you make the jump from hospitality to medical accreditation and those industries?
I think I was just asked. I think you make a lot of decisions based on circumstances and sometimes luck. I mean, I actually went overseas to live in Cambridge because my husband was studying there. And it was there that I first got introduced to medicine because I happened to live at the hospital. And the first day actually was a funny story in that the temping agency I put my name down to, I said, there's a job that we've got for you at Adam Brooks Hospital. I went, oh, fantastic. I live at Adam Brooks Hospital. And I thought, so there wasn't this traveling issue. I put on my suit. I fronted up to the office at Adam Brooks Hospital. And little did I know, it was actually the catering office at Adam Brooks Hospital. And I said, I'm here to do the job. And they said, oh, you're very well dressed. And little did I know that
everything very well dressed.
Well, on this particular day, the universe had me scraping plates in the cafeteria. That was the job for the day. And I had to don this like plastic gown and, you know, those kind of scrunchy headband-y type of things, the head nets sort of thing. And all I was terrified about was the fact that my husband was going to come and eat in the cafeteria and see me scraping the plates. And in fact, the guy who was in charge of me that day said, I'll just give you a training session now. I said, I don't think I need a training session in scraping plates. He says, oh no, we do it a certain way here. So he gave me like this 10-minute training session on scraping these plates. Needless to say, I did my job very well. And I was asked to come back the next day. And they had given me a 2-day posting. And I thought it would be deplorable of me to actually ring the agency up and said, I don't really want to do this. I think my skills are better suited to answering the telephone, for instance. But I thought, no, you know, I'd made a commitment. And I think sometimes you have to do what you say you're going to do. And by the end of day two, in fact, they were so impressed by me that they actually offered me a full-time job, which I graciously declined. And then I said to the agency, do you think you've got something better suited to my skills? And then I ended up working in an office for an IT company that was involved in medical practice. And that's kind of how the journey started.
Very interesting. So just a couple of different circumstances that led you to becoming a CEO.
And I think that's life itself. I mean, had I not then graciously turned them down in terms of the catering department at the hospital and then gone on to work for this IT company that did medical stuff, I possibly might have never become the CEO of AGPAL at the end of the day. And I'm a firm believer that sometimes it's the smallest of decisions that you make that have the biggest impact on your life.
Absolutely. Being a CEO would come with a huge range of challenges, but being a female CEO would have even more so. So as a woman in a high-profile role, how do you approach these difficulties and move on with those challenges?
You know, it's a really good question, but I never really felt confined by being the only woman around a board table. I had 10 directors, all of them men. This was a while ago now, we're talking about, you know, late sort of to around 2010. So it's 25 years ago now, isn't it, really? Oh, actually, less than that. My maths is not very good today, but you know what I mean. A few years ago. So 2000, it was in the 2000s. So it was 25 years ago or so nearly. And I actually just never thought about it. And when I did go into the Telstra Businesswoman Awards and ended up being fortunate enough to win the Queensland Award, that's when people started asking me the question. And it was never a question I'd asked myself. I just got on and did my job. And I never had anything but respect from the people around the table. And maybe they might have had more questions about it than I did, but it was never posed. It was never overt. It was just part, I was always a girl that was just told to go to work and do my best. And I always did that. And in fact, I think in retrospect, maybe it was an advantage rather than a disadvantage. I never thought my gender stopped me from behaving or making the decisions that I made. And I think even had I had a balanced board, I was definitely a girl that didn't believe in glass ceilings. I really never saw a limitation on my decision-making capacity as a result of being a woman. So I didn't really ever regard my gender as being an obstruction to achieving what I wanted to achieve. And maybe I was just naive, but I never really even thought about answering that question until the questions were posed. And then I realised that winning an award like that did give me a voice. And so I did start advocating for the fact that there should be more women in leadership positions, but I was never a believer in quotas. I don't think artificially imposing or mandating a selection process based around gender is a clever one. And I still believe that. I believe that really there is as much opportunity for women as men to go for different opportunities in life when the time is right. One of the limitations women have is that they're perhaps not present to be able to take advantage of those opportunities because they might be off doing equally amazingly valuable things like having children or taking time off to be with aging parents, all of which are equally promotable about being a career path as being a CEO. And I think we take ourselves out of the options to be chosen because we simply have more choice in terms of our everyday lives. So I think that quotas don't work. And I can see the reasons that some big organisations impose them because they need to perhaps evidence the fact that they're meeting KPIs based around gender equity. But I was never a girl, perhaps, as I said, it was a naive view, but I was never a girl that really believed in something artificial on something that should be organic.
For someone who's starting out their career, I know from what you've said, a lot of things kind of just happened the way they did because of the opportunities that were there. But what qualities do you think you had that helped you in those roles? And what advice would you give to people starting out that may have aspirations to become a CEO one day?
I think in retrospect, my creative background was an advantage. I mean, we were selling getting accredited and standards, which are never, quality assurance is not a sexy field, right? But we actually used marketing that made it kind of sexy. Like we used to, I mean, one of our publications was Bridget Jones Groans the Age of Accreditation. Like it was like, and because everyone just says, oh my God, we have to meet these standards. You know, our vaccine fridge has to be this temperature. Our waiting room has to accommodate this many people. I mean, who's going to find that sexy? Certainly not a practice manager and by certainly no means a GP. So we would actually have a bit of a go at ourselves. So we had conferences based around Bridget Jones and, you know, all that jazz and music and made it kind of interesting. So I think my musical creativity background, I think I'm a frustrated marketer, as you would understand, Jamie. You've worked with me for long enough that sometimes you have to say to me, you're not the director of marketing at Hanworth. You're actually, get back in your box, Marisa. You're actually belonging over there. You need to organise, you know, the finances for next month. Just get out of your box. Needless to say, I prefer marketing to finances. You've
Most
seen
people
that.
Do, I think.
Although not you. You're actually equally good at both. But I was always, I think so, I do think the creativity factor was good and being able to laugh about things that were fairly serious. But I think that brought more people along the road with us, both our staff and also the people that we were selling this very bland message to. Bland but important, nevertheless. It was important to get standards in general practice and we tried to do that in a creative, interesting way. So I think that was possibly one of the things that I didn't recognise at the time, but I think musicians are quite mathematical. And I think there is a huge link between maths and music. And I think that finding different ways to sell a message can be done in an artistic pursuit kind of way. And I do think that was possibly one of the things that I brought to the table to make it a bit more entertaining. I liked to think it was entertaining. Yeah. Whether or not it was remains to be seen. So that was probably pretty important. I was also a hard worker. I think, you know, I was brought up in a family. My mother came to Australia as a migrant from Italy at the end of World War II, was displaced. You know, imagine what that must feel like to leave everything that you know and love and simply go to the unknown. So I always was mindful of the fact that my grandmother and my mother found an incredible opportunity in Australia and never found the disadvantages, perhaps their lack of language, their lack of education, as being anything but a small obstacle that they had to overcome. So I was really brought up in a family with a grandmother who lived till nearly 103, who worked and rode a bike till she was nearly 100 and just put a meal on the table, but also felt very grateful to being given an environment that she could thrive in and survive in, because they came here to survive. But in fact, as a result of that, they thrived. So I think those two things, perhaps the artistic pursuits and maybe the ethic and hard work, was possibly two things that stood me in good stead. Can't be sure, but maybe.
And talking about your mum, she was quite successful here. She won couple of competitions that you've told me about, which that was very interesting. Do you want to tell us about that a bit more?
So my mother was, like a lot of mothers, pretty exceptional and, you know, probably a pretty basic education. But again, she stood out from the crowd, I guess. And she, let's talk about 1966 when I was born, and she was doing interesting things like entering competitions. You know, the Women's Weekly would run competitions like the Bake Off competition, which many people would recognise, when you would submit recipes and, you know, the recipe winner would win the equivalent of probably the lottery these days. You know, a car, a sewing machine, a fridge, all these things were pretty expensive. And she always relays it to me like it was the equivalent of winning an RSL home these days. That's the kind of amazing. It was a national competition. She got picked up by Channel 10. She submitted a recipe that was really avant-garde for the time. Would you like to hear what it was?
Yes, absolutely.
It was like beef stuffed with prunes. Like no one stuffs beef with prunes, perhaps an Italian. And my grandmother was not a good cook. She was actually a terrible cook. So I don't know how my mother got to be a good cook, but she was artistic. She was an artist. She was taught by Margaret Ollie when she went to St. Stephen's School, and Margaret Ollie really wanted to mentor her, but my grandmother couldn't afford the lessons, so my mother didn't get mentored by Margaret Ollie. So my mother was artistic. I'm not artistic. I can't paint to save my life. I can't sing to save my life, but my mother could do all of those things. She could sew. I can't sew to save my life either. But she was very creative and quite unique. And I think, so this prune stuffed beef, then wait for it. We encrusted it in a pastry. Like everyone knows, we buy these things at Peter Augustus Meats these days. They're already in pastries and you bake them in the oven. But this was like, oh my goodness, where did you get that idea from?
So is that like a prune stuffed beef Wellington?
Yes, probably. But yet my mother wouldn't have known what beef Wellington was. She just thought it was a good idea. Yeah. Anyway, lo and behold, it got her the National Bake Off champion. She toured the country. She had her hair up in a beautiful beehive and attended these amazing events. And she was offered a television show. Like, that was part of the prize. So she was like two or three episodes in. I think I have pictures of her. We'll have to share a picture of her on Channel 10 and displaying her culinary prowess, and then was pregnant with me. So she had to leave. So she knew what a glass ceiling was, because you couldn't have a pregnant woman on television. So she actually left. And I believe the Bernard King show, which you wouldn't know, Jamie, but I'm sure your mother would remember, started as a result of Bernard taking over from my mother in that day and became hugely successful. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, she was, and she went on to obviously have a couple of children and worked all her life and made decisions based on gut instinct, not really an incredibly hugely scoped educational background, and was always very inspirational. So I had a very working class family. My dad was a policeman. My mother was a secretary in a legal office and then a secretary at a school. But she always did more.
Sounds like a wonderful, wonderful
woman. Yes. And so, you know, it was almost inevitable. I guess she was going to be a large part of my career choices. But she never told me, you know, at the end of grade 12, I don't think music's a really good idea. She always just supported my choices. I came to my own realization that perhaps art was not the best choice. But then again, I wouldn't have been doing what I do now if it wasn't for having had an arts background to start with.
And I think even that background gives you a good or kind of different approach to problem solving sometimes as well, which can help quite a lot in business.
Agree.
So talking about the glass ceiling, which impacted your mum, but you didn't really feel it. Even so, you've been a champion for women empowerment. What do you think are some of the biggest challenges that face women at the moment?
Oh, I'm not sure. I might need a glass of champagne before I actually answer this question. I actually think the biggest challenges now are not that different to challenges that have existed for years. I think women tend to be not as confident in their own abilities. I don't think women are as good at taking risks, calculated risks. I think we tend to step back from risk taking rather than embrace it. Certainly as I've got older, I'm less concerned about what might go wrong than the bigger picture of what might go right. And I think that's probably a fundamental of the gender debate in a broader sense. I think we are given as many opportunities, even though it sometimes doesn't seem like it. I just don't think we're quite as confident and prepared to go out and seek and take them. And it might be, again, a naive view. It's a very operational view from my perspective. But if I look back, I was probably faced with a whole lot more opportunities that I could have taken and didn't, because I was worried about the consequence of failing. I think there's a lot of bravado in men, and I think it's intrinsic in upbringing and the way you bring up boys as opposed to girls. I don't have a son, so I can't speak with any degree of absolute comprehensive understanding. But there is a very different sense in what's girly and what's boy, and I think that is manifest in how children are brought up and what they choose to do. And so I don't think essentially the challenges that face women these days are that different. In fact, I think some of them are a little bit softer than perhaps my mother or my grandmother faced. And I think when you're talking about making a decision based on survival, which is my grandmother, you know, leaving a country to be able to survive and seek a better existence, is really that's a much bigger decision than my decision about whether or not to jump ship from the music career because I might find a greener pasture. They're very different decisions, but essentially the decision-making process that you go through is pretty similar. You know, how much will I risk by going in this direction than by staying right where I am? So I'm a firm believer that it's not that different these days. It's just the content might be different, but the process by which you would make a decision to go one way other or down one road as opposed to another is not that different. One of the biggest decisions, for instance, I faced was the decision to leave the CEO job, because I was actually advised by an incredible mentor of mine who always said to me, you should always leave a job when you don't think it can get any better. You know, people leave a job when it's actually going downhill. I think that is a fault a lot of us make. I think we stay too long. And same could be even said of marriages, you know, big life events. Sometimes you stay too long doing the one thing because it's comfortable. And it is, you know, when your financial security is tied up in what you do, when your sense of identity is tied up in what you do. You know, how many times do you get asked, Jamie, what do you do? Not, you know, what's important to you. I don't know what I do these days, but we do fall into the trap of it being comfortable to not leave.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I fell into, I always had that feeling in the back of my mind that when AgPal had its 10th birthday and we had this amazing creative conference in Melbourne, and we had more people attend than ever before. And I can't remember who we had singing, but we probably had the Choir of Hard Knocks or something like that. It was so musical. It was so creative. It was amazing when all these people from the Choir of Hard Knocks, which was an incredible organization, walked through the ground hard in Melbourne, and they were actually showing them the door. And I said, no, 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 they're our stage act. They're our plenary session. They've got to come in. We have to keep these people out. I said, no, they're invited in. They're being paid to be here. So let them come in the doors, because we had got them to talk about how music in medicine was really important, and how music in life and in recovery and in peace of mind and in mental health was really important. That's why they were there. And doctors often suffer from mental health issues. So that's why we got the choir in. But anyway, that was the conference that I said, my job cannot get any better. This is the peak of my career. It's time to leave.
Yeah. Going back just a little bit, do you think really the biggest challenge is a mindset one in women, that they don't have that self-confidence to say that they can do those roles and that the risk is too high if they fail?
It's a really hard question. No, I don't think it's just mindset. I think opportunity's got a lot to do with it. I think luck has a lot to do with it. I think there's a lot of people who prefer to only say yes if they feel really comfortable and really confident. So I guess if you're talking about lack of self-confidence, I would say it's the lack of the confidence to say yes when you're so consumed about what could go wrong if you did. For me, I'm speaking from personal experience. Yeah. I would have chosen to not go down that road because I think there was a much bigger chance of me failing than taking that road that was easier. And I think we all have a bit of that in us. Yeah. I think men probably have that kind of same decision in them, but they don't seem to think that deeply. They seem to think less deeply about it than women, I think. So, yeah, it's a hard one for me to answer for a lot of women. I think it must be different. Circumstances, the family environment, the financial incentives and the financial risk if you fail, cultural challenges. There are a lot of cultures in which women wouldn't pursue one thing over another because culturally it's not comfortable for you. So I think all of those things play a role. And I think those things play a role at different times in your life. I don't think it's organic. I think you do faced with reasons to say no differently at different times in your life. I'm not sure if that answers the question very well.
No, absolutely. And like if an opportunity were to come at a different part of time in your life, then you may react differently to it. Just depends on what you're placing importance on. And
yeah, like if someone said to me, how about buying an old house and doing it up 10 years before I was ready to do it, I would have said, no, I have a very comfortable career as a CEO. Why would I risk that to do something ridiculous like that? Yet look, fast forward 10 years later, when I had made the decision to leave AgPal and I was without a job for a year, and I can honestly say to you that it was one of the most difficult periods of my life. My daughter was in grade 11 or so, and that's why I made the decision to step down so I could spend a bit more time with her, because it was great to be based in Brisbane, but it was a head office and I was forever flying elsewhere to do my work. I was often away 2 or 3 days. Sometimes my husband and I didn't even tell each other where we were going, and we found ourselves in the same city one night without even knowing we were there.
Oh, no, that's my favourite story.
I know, that's a hilarious story. And we didn't even get together that night because I said, oh, no, I'm reading board papers. And he says, yeah, actually, I'm going to bed too. And we're like in hotels on the different side of the road. That's when I knew my life was out of control, that we didn't even ask the question where we were going, just see you Friday.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when I made that decision to leave, and everyone used to say, what are you doing now? And I didn't have an answer. And I felt quite characterless. Like I couldn't say, oh, I'm going to restore a house. I'm going to work casually. I'm going to contract. I'm going to consult. I didn't have an answer. My mother was soon to be quite ill, and so in a way it was a blessing in disguise that I left when I did. But The reality is I didn't have something to define myself with. And that was a really challenging. I felt a bit worthless that year, I must admit. And when I look back at it, I think I kind of left AGPA without thinking what I was going to do next, just that I knew I had to leave it because it was the best it was and it will never be that good again. So I left with a leap of faith that something else would find me or I would find something else. But for the first few months, I didn't find anything. I did my real estate license to just buy the time, and I did have a property that I tinkered with and started to do some renovations on with a team, which was, again, a whole new corporate work for me. It was, I loved the labourers, I loved the project management, I loved the budgeting, I loved figures at that point in my time. I didn't like reporting to a board anymore, I was reporting to myself. And so I did set up on a new road that was one that I never thought would actually be one for me. But I did find that.
So what led you to the purchase of Hanworth?
Well, I spent a couple of years just doing smaller projects and renovating smaller houses, and really loved it because it was very fulfilling. I mean, you could see the change in where, I mean, I quite love the concept of housing people, and I loved I learnt that there was a lot of corporate people travelling, not necessarily just students, which were a lot of student houses at the time. And because I had a daughter who was coming out of school, I thought I'd like to create a house that people that are coming to Brisbane for the first time, I like to live in. And so that's was my kind of my brain power was looking at student accommodation originally. But then I stumbled on, it was a very big era for Brisbane, particularly when there was a lot of fly-in, fly-out workers on the mines. Yeah. It was, mining was booming and people were going out there for a couple of weeks and coming back for a week or so and needing to find accommodation locally and work remotely. And so it was, again, quite an opportunity. It just kind of flung into my lap. And so I did one house and then I did another one and did another one. And I said, you know, I think I need a big house. And during those few months, whilst I was really enjoying that, my mother had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and that was a very brutal and awful disease that claimed her life not but 14 months later. So in a way, it was a blessing that I was doing what I was doing because I was very flexible. I could leave the workers on the job and I could go to the Gold Coast where she lived and I could be with her, and I don't think I was with her enough in retrospect. I wish I had spent a lot more time at that point in my life with her. I guess I always thought that it wouldn't be the end. I always thought she would bounce back, and she never really shared, I think, her fears. And it's one thing I really regret, not being able to speak more openly with her about that journey. It's because I guess it was, I mean, I've been through a journey myself, and I think I also didn't want to talk about it. So I think we are kind of optimists. Maybe externally optimist, but maybe internally quite pessimistic. And I think my mum was probably quite the same. So I was able to do that. So at the time that she passed away, I was looking for a bigger project. And she passed away in May of 2012. And I stumbled upon Hanworth. I always say when my heart was aching for the loss of my mother. And I live across the road from Hanworth, and I had never seen this incredible house. It was, for those of you that know it, that you will know that it's perched up above the road. So you don't really see it. It's kind of hidden in the trees. I used to liken it to the Thomasina movie on Disney when I was a kid growing up. There used to be these amazing stories about Thomasina the cat, and there was this kind of house that had all these bushes around it, and people would go through these bushes to find the house. And that was what Hanworth was like. I never knew it existed until there was a for sale sign or a tender sign placed on the house. And then I explored it. I looked at another couple of properties at the time, and then I saw this house, and there was something about this house that just said, this is it. My husband thought I was completely, like, I dropped off the edge of the earth, like I was completely insane. He thought he said, look at the roof. You'll have to replace the roof. Well, I knew full well that the roof was the only good feature about the house. The rest of it was completely falling down, but I knew the roof was pretty good. And he thought that was the only thing that needed to be done to it. That was completely the opposite. We are completely mentally opposite. He came to the house and said, the roof needs to be replaced. I came to the house thinking, the roof's okay. Everything else needs to go. But that is that's kind of the story of my life in many respects. But Hanworth became ours in November of that year. And so I always say it became my distraction from the death of my mother and my salvation. at the same time, and I'll very much stand by that. And I decided I would dedicate the restoration of the house to my mother. And that became a really fulfilling journey in terms of I made decisions based on what would my mother do.
Yeah. And that was a really interesting decision to make, because it wasn't until later, after the rest or during the restoration, that you found out that that had previously been done with Hanworth before, when it had been purchased and named in honour of their mother.
Correct. So that was, I think, all of us who work here share this incredible sense that there's something about this house and it's something bigger than us. So I found out during the course of the restoration that Mary Weinhold had bought the house in memory of her mother exactly 100 years to the year that I bought the house in memory of mine. And that was the first link to at least, I would say, 100 links since about things that resonated about what I was doing here with what she was doing. She was philanthropic. You know, I turned to philanthropy as another guide to actually line this house with some sense of depth and goodness, because she raised money for the RSPCA. We don't allow pets here, but nevertheless, we benefit other causes. She used fates to actually raise money. She housed women. I had the sense that I wanted to house people even before this. She worked with the Brisbane community to further her cause, and I would like to think I do that these days as well. So really, the restoration of Hanworth really has been, I would say, the most pivotal moment in my life. Finding Hanworth and turning Hanworth into something bigger than me has probably been, I always say, I think this is the reason I was put on earth. I mean, I liked having a daughter, Isabella, as well. I believe that she was also a reason I was put on the earth, but she always calls Hanworth the second child, although sometimes Bella has been known to announce to the world that she is the second child. And in fact, Hanworth is her first, is Maurice's first daughter. And I understand why she says that sometimes.
I think she, if I remember right, she says that in the Heart of Hanworth documentary too that we just put up on YouTube. In that, you mentioned Hanworth being hidden away and having all its history and having such a huge impact in so many people's lives, and most people didn't even know it existed here. And I think even as we have people walk through here to look at, see if they want to have private events, they say the same sort of thing, that they drive past every single day, but they didn't even know the house is here until they see the tree with all the fairy lights, the happy tree.
The happy tree.
Was that a reason for putting that there? Or was it just a happy coincidence?
No, the happy tree just became the happy tree. It's a beautiful poinciana that's on the front lawn of Hanworth overlooking Brisbane City. And I don't even remember why we lit it up. It was probably lit up before lighting up streets becomes a big thing in Brisbane, whereas now, I mean, how much happiness does lighting up a street give? You know, the beautiful main streets of Bulimba or, you know, Mowbray Park, there's all these absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous places that have trees. So it was my ambition to light up the Hanworth tree. And I think that was a celebration moment. It was when we had lost Hanworth, you know, in the fire, a fire which we can talk about maybe another day. I'm not quite sure. That would take an entire podcast on its own to talk about. But a few months after purchasing Hanworth and being ready to open, an arsonist lit Hanworth on fire and destroyed 85% of it overnight and just before it was due to open. So that took us back down to ground zero. So I think the lighting of the tree...
Heartbreaking moment.
Correct. Correct.
Suffering quite a lot.
You know, we didn't need yet another kind of another pivotal event in our life after losing my mother almost a year before that. But we got it. And, you know, heaven help us, that's what happened. And you pick yourself up, but it's very difficult to do that. And so lighting the tree was symbolic in that it was time to live again. And I can't even remember exactly when we put the lights on it, but we worked with Running Man. I had to mortgage my house to actually afford the lights for the tree, because in that instance, they were a pretty big investment, but it's never an investment I've regretted. We used to just light it on special occasions originally. Now we light it every night because we think every day is to be celebrated. And the possibilities that each day holds and the privilege it is to have enjoyed another day on earth and with our community and our friends. So it comes on at sunset and it goes off, you know, sort of close to midnight. And I think it becomes, it's been one of those things, you know, people now say, oh, the house with the lights. Yeah. And so it has always become the happy tree, because I think I always say I've actually had some of my saddest moments under the happy tree. And it just got the name the happy tree because it always makes me feel just slightly better after being underneath it.
A huge part of Hanworth has become your dedication to the community and your philanthropy. How did you make the decision about which charities you wanted to support? Because I know Women's Legal Service was probably the first one that was announced on the opening of the house.
Yes.
So moving forward, how do you make that decision on who to support?
So just taking one step back, I mean, I was not a girl that grew up in a family that was particularly philanthropic, but they always gave. So that, I guess that makes them by default a family that is philanthropic. It would be the dollar to the salvos, you know, the kind of the appeal, the hospital appeal, salvos that come to the door every year, the door knockers. Probably doesn't even happen anymore, does it really? But I always saw my mum and dad always give them something. So I would have typified myself as not growing up in a household that had a lot of disposable income, but they always gave the small amount that they could. And I think that's a really big lesson. To give small is for me, the biggest give you can give. It doesn't have to be a big gift. Just small gifts regularly is kind of what you need to do. So when I...
Giving your time.
Giving time. Yes.
Just as impactful.
Pro bono stuff is really equally as valuable as giving a coin. And then I joined Zonta International when I was a businesswoman. I had another wonderful mentor, Dr. Mary Marnie, who was an incredible woman and first to do so many things in Brisbane. And I was very lucky to work for her as her secretary, actually. And that really propelled me into the medical industry in Brisbane. I was very lucky. And she got me to join Zonta many, many years ago. And that's an organization that advances the status of women worldwide. And they do incredibly valuable things. Have a local impact, but also a global impact. So it's terrific from that perspective. So giving actually became part of my mantra, even though I didn't really realise it. What really positioned Hanworth as a place to give was that when I lost most of Hanworth in the fire, the first people that came in were certainly not my bank financiers. I mean, Hanworth was totally mortgaged. But did I see a banker come to me and ask if they could help? Absolutely not. Did I see people that I thought could help or would help come? No. The people that most came were the people that could least afford the time. And that was my friends and the local community that came in and gave the fireman here, you know, breakfast. Or my neighbour who came and did my makeup because she thought that the TV cameras would be there all day. I mean, as if I would have thought about the cameras, like, no way. I just looked bedraggled and completely heartbroken, almost on adrenaline, because I didn't have a chance to think about it till that afternoon when I just completely broke down. By that time, the television cameras had gone, but it was like, you know, when you do anything on adrenaline, there's that very big come down that takes you to lower than you ever imagined. So I just suddenly thought that when all the builders left site because they couldn't come back for months because the insurers failed to act for many, many months after the fire, that I had to give back to the community. And in fact, it had to be with the help of the community that we would rebuild Hanworth. So we started even selling advertising space on this huge front wall that we've got. So the builders were the first to give. The architect gave. Somerville House gave, you know, a small amount that made such a big difference. They got their name plastered on the outside to say, we are helping to rebuild Hanworth. And people started to come in and say, how could we help? And a lot of it was just time, you know, sweeping and polishing furniture that could be saved. All the ash went over everything. All the water damaged everything. It was just that people were so good. You always realize the goodness in people when you most need it. And if you think about the pivotal events in Australia over the last few years, bushfires and floods, it brings out the best in people, generally speaking. It actually brings out more good than harm. So I think the philanthropic interest of Hanworth was organic. It just became part of the culture. And in answer to your question about how do we choose to support what we choose to support, it's pretty organic as well. Women's Legal Service happened to walk in one day when Hanworth looked terrible and lonely and lost. and wanted a photo shoot venue that would be able to articulate the important work they do regarding huge issue of domestic violence in our community, but wanted to depict women and their families as lonely and lost and not necessarily battered, which I think was a really big shift in depiction of domestic violence. And this was, you know, we're talking about sort of 2013 here. You know, it was quite a long time ago now when domestic violence is not in the media like it is now. People are not talking openly and honestly. Well, not so honestly, but like more openly than they ever were. They're talking about it now. But this was an era when Women's Legal Service were really progressive and said, we need a venue to depict rural women and women who are lonely and lost and looking for shelter. And we think you can offer us all that in this like photo shoot place. And I just was completely enamored by the work that they were doing. And so it was a natural progression that they became my first charity of choice. And we are here celebrating 10 years of working with the Women's Legal Service and never for a day questioned that decision. Yet it was a decision that was made totally on what I saw, the way they handled each other, handled women who they were actually working with, and articulated their goal and their ambition for a world that's free of domestic violence, which is still basically their ambition now. And it kind of articulated a wonderful future in terms of a charity of choice. And that kind of the same process has dictated every choice we've made since. Now we celebrate we support Women's Legal Service in the domestic violence space. We support the Mater Foundation for their work with ovarian and breast cancer, ovarian in tribute to my mother, and the fact that I also have been unlucky enough to get breast cancer soon after my mother died. And we also wonderfully, almost back to my roots, supporting the arts. And we wonderfully support, huge supporters of the Ballet International Gala and the Brisbane Festival. And that probably is a testament to my history and creativity in music and arts, which is where I started.
In recognition to your service in corporate and philanthropic works, you were appointed a member of the Order of Australia in 2017. How did that feel?
I thought it was a joke because I don't know if you know a lot about this, but apparently people nominate you and then there's all this big process about getting other people to agree with them. Yeah. But I, to this day, have no idea who nominated me. It's all very like secret squirrel. So I got this letter at home that was very official, you know, sort of Governor General of Australia kind of letter. And I said, oh, this is a joke. Like someone's playing a joke on me. And my daughter got home from work that day and I said, Bella, I think this is letter that is not like, I think it's a joke. She said, I think it's true. I said, do you think it is? And then I said, no, it can't be true. And that you've got to then accept the nomination. And so then I actually rang the office because I actually still didn't. I said, I got this letter in the mail. They said, yes. Like they were thinking there's this lunatic on the phone asking if this letter's legit. And I said, can you just check that my name's on the list? And they said, yes. Yes, Mrs. Vecchio, you know, your name is on the list. I went, oh, who nominated me? Oh, no, we can't give out that information. You just have to be, you know, kind of satisfied with the fact that people thought you were worthy enough to nominate and it's a real nomination and I can legitimize it and it's up to you to accept it or otherwise. And I said to Bella, should I accept this? She said, hell yeah, I want to go to Government House, she said. So it was very lovely. It was very humbling. And I must admit, one of the things about being philanthropic is that it actually has been quite an advantage. I think putting letters after your name actually legitimizes you somehow. And so I don't feel so bad about asking people for money anymore. Maybe as Marisa Vecchio, I might have felt a little bit less kind of confident. But Marisa Vecchio AM, I think, you know, hell yeah, you look at the AM because someone else has legitimized me and the Governor General of Australia has legitimized me.
I've been accredited as a philanthropist.
I know. So give me your $1,000 because I deserve it. So it's become a little bit of a talking point that it kind of somehow, Bella used to actually laugh about it and say, you know, that's Marisa Vecchio AM. Well, I started to put it on my Qantas Club because I thought maybe they would upgrade me. But let me tell you, it's never happened. It's caused more harm than good because when you're looking for your name, you have to look for Vecchio AM. And I never look for Vecchio AM. I look for Vecchio. And so I can never find my flight. They say, no, that flight doesn't exist. And let me tell you, I've never, ever been upgraded. So it doesn't work.
Since then, QUT gave you an honorary doctorate as well. So you're technically Dr. Marisa Vecchio AM.
I know.
Has that got you any upgrades?
No, that hasn't. I don't tend to use that. Honorary doctorates are very, I mean, again, I was very flattered. And I did do my MBA at QUT. And I loved the institution. I was the president of the alumni for many years, and I was on the council of QUT for many years as well. And it's a wonderful organisation, and I really think it's a fantastic tertiary institution. And, in fact, my daughter ended up graduating from QUT as well. And, again, humbled. I don't know how that happened. And it was one of those things that you get to wear, those big floppy hats. And again, Isabella's always taking the mickey out of me because it was a terribly hot day that the graduation was. And I thought it was a really good excuse to buy a nice Zimmerman dress because I've never had a Zimmerman dress. So I kind of used it as an opportunity to go and buy a Zimmerman dress, which proceeded to not be shown at all because it was under this big, hugely heavy tunic. But I decided I would milk this tunic all day. And you know how hard it is to get a table at Julia's. And so after the ceremony, I was sweltering. I was dripping down because, you know, it was so hot. This huge hat, this huge woolen kind of tunicky gown, which you get to keep, which is lovely. And we trekked across from QPAC to Julius. And Isabella said, my mother's just got a doctorate and be made a doctor. And we really deserve a table. And for once in my life, it worked that day. If nothing else, to get that jolly tunic off and my floppy hat was actually really good. So it did open doors at Julia's restaurant for me that day.
Well, there you go. If you can't get a table, you know what you need to do now.
Nowadays, I just have to go to the back of line like everybody else. No amount of kind of throwing a doctorate under their noses will actually work. But the big floppy hat must have done it that day for me. So I'm still waxing lyrical about it being a positive.
After achieving all of this so far, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Isn't that funny? It's just I think back at when we ask little kids, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? So I like the question about what do you want to be rather than what do you want to do, because your jobs, as I said before, really define us, and sometimes they define us rather too much. I have the most incredible accolades for single women and single mothers, because when I was a working mother, when I was at home when Isabella was a baby, was actually the hardest 3 months of my life before I went back to work. It was much easier to be in the office for a day than it was to be at home with a small child, as you can attest to, Jamie, having had the beautiful Atlas and been through this. Sometimes just handing Isabella to my husband, saying, she's yours, I'm going on a walk, was the best part of the day. Yeah. We all know that. We love them to death, but going back to work was an easy decision for me because I loved it and I was challenged by my work and I was able to combine both, very fortunately. So what you want to be when you grow up, I think we would answer that question in so many different ways, different stages of our life, but I think I want to be remembered. I actually don't think I want to be something or someone. I think I want to be remembered, whether that's as a wife and mother and the contribution I made to family and providing for them, whether it's a good friend. I hope I'm a good friend. I try to be a good friend to a lot of people. Whether it's trying to do something to positively impact on someone's life, or I'm fortunate that I've turned Hanworth into a legacy project. I want this house to continue to give. I want this house to somehow be gifted so that it continues to give for another 100 years. I don't want it to be a drain on someone's purse. I want it to be sustainable. I think the model that we've created here for business about offering accommodation and the opportunity for people to experience Hanworth in events and other philanthropic endeavours is really good. It's working so far, but a house like this takes a lot to maintain. And a house like this can only ever get worse. It can never get better in terms of the maintenance that's got to continually go into it to actually keep it up to standard. So I think what I want to be is remembered. And that will mean different things to different people. So I think that's probably what I want to be. I want to have made my mark. I love that everyone knows my favorite quote in the world is, you make a living by what you get, but you make a life by what you give. And I've really turned my corporate role, I think, about getting a job into making or evolving a job around giving. And the business of Hanworth is a business around giving. It's not a business around getting. Of course, we get accommodation and we give accommodation. But I think getting to giving is the difference between saying, what do you want to do when you grow up, and what do you want to be, or what do you want to be remembered? I think I want to be remembered.
That's beautiful. Love that. So I have one last question for you. And that
do I need another sip of my champagne before I answer this question? I'll sip it slowly so I've got time to think about it.
What brings you the most happiness in life?
The happy tree brings a lot of happiness, just as a kind of, you know, an aside.
It's aptly named.
I think a sense of place brings me happiness. But by far, if I had to tell you what my happiest place was, it's on the beach. And I was thinking about, why does the beach bring so much happiness? And I think if you're standing on a shore, which is rather like life itself, I think it's the one place that I can think of that consumes all my senses. So obviously, we all know the smell of sea air. There's nothing like it, right?
Absolutely.
We all know the taste of the salt in the sea air and the touch between the sand between our toes or the water around us that engulfs us. But I think most prominently, we have that sense of hearing, almost a sense of, you know, movement. Like, you never hear nothing at the beach. You always hear something. It's either the waves splashing or the breeze or the sound of laughter and people enjoying themselves. There's never a negative or sad moment at the beach. During COVID there was, but then we weren't allowed to stay on the beach anyway. So even when you went to the beach, it was your excuse to go to exercise because you were allowed to be at the beach. But it's the sight for me that's the most overwhelming thing. We're on the shores of something that we don't quite know what lies beyond it. There's that sea that's constantly changing, constantly full of its own challenges, full of its own risks, can be quite a terrifyingly dangerous place. And that's kind of like life itself. But unless we actually take a step out from that shore and explore and immerse ourselves in that which we don't know, we will never, ever be able to enjoy what it offers. So for me, walking the national park in Noosa and sitting on Noosa Beach, which everyone knows is undoubtedly my favourite place on earth, I think I love it so much because of what it represents as a metaphor for life. I think it's perched on the edge of something great, but not quite knowing how great it can be unless we go there. That's what brings me happiness.
I hope you've all learned something new today about Marisa. And if you have any questions, you can get in touch with us at info@hanworthhouse.com.au. See what else we're doing, you can follow us at Hanworth House on Instagram and YouTube, and subscribe to the podcast to get notified of the future episodes. As a thank you for listening today, we wanted to give you the opportunity to win 2 tickets to every Hanworth hosted event in 2023. Just head to hanworthhouse.com.au/win before March 26th, and we will be back soon with another special guest. Cheers!
Cheers!